Welcome to Peter's Podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. Imagine a paradise of palm trees, rice paddies, beautiful people, beautiful colors, wonderful weather in the middle of February, and yoga to boot. That's the retreat in Bali, February 2020, led by Aino Sirin and myself, with special guest Wendy Newton, February 8 through 15. Check out the show notes for a link, or see peterfurco.com for more information. Can't wait to go. Can't wait to see you there. Bali. Big hawk. Did you see him?
No.
He was sitting on the fence.
It's hilarious. You're seeing all the birds when I'm driving, and you're seeing all the birds when you're driving.
Yeah. I trust in the spontaneity, I said, and Wendy added, of Brahman. So here we are in our spontaneous on-the-road podcast, us and Jack Kerouac, on the holidays of lights. We are currently driving on Route 80/90 through Ohio, where Wendy went to school.
Where I went to school. A guy who I went to school with once, when I was in the car with him driving back from school, made up a poem about Ohio. And it went like this. As high as the sky is, the clouds are so low in Oberlin, Ohio. So shout out to Jeff from Oberlin.
I like it.
And it's true, the clouds are low and the sky is high and the landscape is flat.
Here we are, literally driving to the Midwest. It's quite fun. We've got Micah in the back seat, horses out there in the field. We've passed cows, pigs, an eagle.
Maybe two
eagles. Big hawk. And here we are in the festivals of the light. The time of the darkness in the year, the solstice of winter. When the night is its longest, the day is its shortest. Our colleague Aino is in Lapland, enjoying the darkness. And we're on our way to the grandchildren.
Who are the light?
There you go. So, I thought we would share a little bit of our thoughts about this holiday of light. I said in meditation class the other day that we look outward first, but ultimately the light that we're looking for is inward. The source of our light is inward, which I think is relevant to something Wendy said about 50 miles ago, about as without, so within. So I'm going to invite Wendy to jump in there.
So I've been thinking a lot lately about this saying that we have, which is mostly said in yoga circles that have a tantric underpinning, but also not just in yoga, but in other types of practices or modalities that have tantric underpinnings. And it's as above, so below. And sometimes we say, as within, so without, as well. And I have been thinking about the opposite of those sayings and hearing a lot of wisdom in as below, so above, and also as without, so within. And I think those things can be, I don't know that everybody would really quite be able to follow where I've gone with that, but as above, so below, you know, the reverse is as below, so above. So there we have, you know, kind of what I would call involution, evolution, or, you know, to put it really simply, like, if we're here, we can imagine that what's going on in the cosmos is related to what's happening here. And sometimes I think it's easiest to start there. And in Tantra, we specifically do start there. But when we say as within, so without, we can imagine that, like, once we do our yoga, if we're like going inside, then we could say, okay, so what we're seeing outside of ourselves is like a reflection of what we are seeing inside. But if you turn it around and you say, what, like, the first place that we look is outside of ourselves, and if we follow that in, sometimes we can arrive at the place where we even understand how we're seeing things. Like, if you just understand, oh, I'm looking, there's a me who's looking out, and there is where I'm located, but it's not really there. I'm really located, it's in here, in this internal perspective.
So when you're saying without, you're including, like, our own experience of the external.
Yeah, the external and the internal is what we're talking about when, if you've ever heard the term relational yoga, right? It's like yoga is not just about our relationship with Source, but it's also about our relationship with the external world. Like, you could think of it like vertical and horizontal. And so if we're, you know, some of the first kind of types of practices that we could think about doing are like, how am I seeing things? How am I receiving sensory information? How is my mind processing that? How am I identifying what's the difference between my mind that processes sensory data and is just like, is kind of more ego-based or identity-based, and the part of me that is not I would say absorbed or involved in those thoughts and sensory experiences. And that's as within, so without, as without, so within, right? So it's this relationship of outer to inner and inner to outer, rather than relationship of you know, you could say like your ego to your soul or something like that. But I forgot why you actually had me say that. Had me talk about that. We have to do easy pass.
I brought that up because, you know, we're at this place in the year where a lot of the social things that happen, and when I say social, I mean society. In other words, we have a society that embodies a lot of the knowing that we've accumulated over time, and the societal habits of the moment, of this, what we're doing right now, ask us to reflect on the notion of a dark time and a finding of the light, whether it's in Hanukkah, or it's in Christmas, or it's in the solstice. you have this encouragement to find the light in the darkness.
Yeah.
And I was saying that we use the outward form as the first lesson, but the ultimate lesson is to learn that the darkness is a frame of mind or a part of mind, and that the light is also a frame of mind and a part of mind. And of course there are Sanskrit words for all of this, but it's encouraging us to have jiva mukti, to take what you were calling the mind that's engrossed in the objects of the world and to align with the me, the part that is pure conscious of everything. And that those things happen all the time. They're always happening. The consciousness is never not there, but our attention gets taken by other stuff. And in that taking, we feel the lack of that moment. We feel in the dark. And so the reminder of the season is, hey, there's light. Find the light. Right? There's light just past this darkness. And we use the season as a as without an example of that.
Well, the way that I am hearing it in your in this moment is that, you know, we forget, you know, when we're out there just kind of embroiled in our drama of whatever it is, we forget. And, you know, at least some of the traditions speak about, like, in the darkest, in the dark times, it's not that there's no light, it's just that you're not seeing the light, like, exactly. You know, and that we kindle the light in the dark times, literally, seasonally, because we want to remember that it's there, but it's also, so it's real and seasonal, but it's also metaphorical for, you know, that when we're in that state of sort of, you would say, attachment or embroilment, and we've forgotten about the light, then it's the time to go in and remember that the light that is us is always shining. And you're so eloquently reminding us that it's the light that we're speaking of is the light of consciousness, and that that's never not there, but we do daily often forget that it is. And so that's the practice, is to sort of touch base with that awareness daily, so that we're doing that. But this season also is that season that, you know, we're kind of inward, we're naturally inward, and that has a different kind of a quality, you know, like if you think about what you're doing when it's warmer out, or when it's the sun is in a different position and you feel very outwardly oriented, like there's a time for that.
Right, we were just listening to Anna Marie Cox on a podcast called With Friends Like These, and she said at the end, she was trying to be extraordinarily PC, but not in a social way, but in a real way. Like, what are we really talking about? And she said, you know, this is a time when I am more inclined to be self-reflective. And, you know, that's what I think you just said.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, you know, like all of the metaphors that are embedded in this, honey, you gotta go that way. All of the metaphors that are sort of embedded in the traditions that we know about and live with are coming from realities.
Exactly, they're coming from, yeah, and that's why I say it's very much a matter of a culture creates, assists, it embodies its learning into traditions and into education, so that the people don't have to start from scratch every time. We pass on what we've learned.
Yeah. I would use the word encodes.
Yeah. And so when you do a thing like Christmas, there's or any of the holidays, you know, there's a layering of the meanings for the that are appropriate to the understanding of the participants. And what's kind of sad right now, and we get a little bit of this from sort of a nationalism perspective almost, where you go, well, you know, Jesus is the reason for the season, so what are you saying happy holidays for? You know, that's sort of a misunderstanding of why, what's missing from Christmas is it's not about Christmas presents. It's about, you know, seeing the light of the star, following that star light to Christ consciousness, to consciousness that transcends our individual consciousness. That's what's lost in the season in its materialistic form.
Yeah, I would agree. And also that not every tradition speaks of it as Christ consciousness. You know, that there's so many ways to speak about this metaphor, which is so basic to all humanity, because we live on planet Earth and the sun changes position with regard to the planet, and we have this season where we go into a kind of a hibernation time, an inward time, and you know, different traditions in different times have spoken about it in different ways. And I think I was saying before, you know, I'm kind of like a purist and a pluralist at the same time. You know, I think that all of the ways that we talk about these realities, and in this case, how we go internal to find a connection with the source of consciousness that we are, right? But it can be spoken of in so many different ways, and I think that all of those ways are valid unto themselves. Yeah. If they stay related to the fact that it's not a metaphor, it's speaking about a reality. And then that's the way, in my mind, or to my way of thinking, how we can, that's hilarious.
Yes.
We're passing a sign that says Jesus is alive.
But it says beyond reasonable doubt, Jesus is alive.
Beyond reasonable doubt, Jesus is alive. Yeah, so I mean, once I think we get to the place where it's like, you know, Christmas is about Jesus, we've lost the way completely. But that doesn't mean that believing that Jesus was a figure that brought light to the world is a bad thing, or you know what I mean? It's valid unto itself, but that also means that, you know, you have to consider that all of the other ways of describing and practicing this reality are, or living according to this reality, are also valid unto themselves.
Right.
And that I don't know, I feel like that is, you know, politically and I would say sociologically, like what we're really losing in these, what we call post-truth times, which is, it's just really scary to me.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, it's also the debate, like there's nothing wrong with debating things, but the solutions are not solutions to important problems. There are solutions to problems that we've already resolved and now we're just recreating them in stupid ways.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't mean to get into a culture war. It's just a matter of being in Ohio going almost into Indiana. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a vibration here.
Well, there's definitely signage.
Yeah.
I keep kind of going back in my mind to this, you know, where I kind of went when you asked me the question to begin with, and I'm really thinking about that external, internal, internal, external axis, and that relational axis, as in terms of what that means for yoga or yogic kind of thinking, and what that might have to do with this seasonal, like, it is a little bit like that sociological conversation, but just to take it back to yoga. You know, we tend to see things primarily externally, and we also externalize things that we feel. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
And so the first place when we go to do our practice or to help people do their practice, for those of you that are practitioners, you know, it's really useful to remember that we have to meet them in their external place where they are. And we have to meet ourselves in those places where we get stuck in the external world and forget that it's about what's happening inside. And we have to also kind of give ourselves a little compassion about those places where we're like really blind to that and we don't understand it. And for me, those places are like when I get judgmental or angry or upset about something that I'm encountering out there in the world, then I have to kind of trace it back, if I'm doing my yoga, to the internal place where I'm kind of stuck on something, or it's making me, you know, there's an unconscious thought of some kind that's really making me react, rather than be able to sit with the response of, or the just even the understanding of what it is. And I think that in the world at large right now, we're just so far away from that, you know, we're just so, like, you could take a whole year of studies with somebody who's never heard about that, and they'd still look at you sideways if you say it's about what's happening inside of you. And we tend to really feel that way when we're charged up about something or feel really judgmental about it. So I think it really relates to this time when, you know, everybody really is practicing a different thing. And some people are just, you know, sitting in a pile of consumer goods that they got on Amazon and screaming about Jesus. You know, it's, you know, I that's a reality in the world. That's not up to me to really judge, actually.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
even though I do just, judge it, you know.
Just to go back to something you said just before that, you know, this notion of getting upset about something or something is happening, very often the first thing that occurs to us is it's something outside of us that's making us upset. That's, we are mad that that outside thing is happening, or it did something to us. And I think you aptly put it that it's happening inside of us. There's something inside of us that is creating the friction, the as within, so without part, right? And Swami Rama wrote a translation and a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita that I've been reading this year, trying to look at things from a more of a psychological perspective, but he calls it perennial psychology. And his the point that I think is relevant to what you were just saying is that when you do a meditative practice, when you do a yoga practice, at whatever level you can do it, your aim is to gain control, and control is a tricky word, right? Like gain an understanding of your mind, but not just your conscious mind, but to gain a clarity of the part of your mind that is operating without your even being aware of it anymore, right? That whether it's something buried or it's something that you, the way you were born or whatever, but to come to an understanding of the entirety of your mind, which in the Yoga Sutras, of course, you would call citta vritti, right? The movements of the mind. And
but also the samskara, the unconscious, the samskaras, which, sorry, also the samskaras, which it describes as being unconscious or conscious.
Exactly. And so then by, through your practice, you gain control. Again, I'm using these words knowing that they are potentially charged too. It's, you gain.
Can I say something? Sure. Can I just interject? So you for me anyway, you're not necessarily gaining control. That's a very masculine way of thinking about it, but what you're doing is you're making what was unconscious conscious. And there, when you do that, then you, when it's conscious and you're, you can see it from the perspective of the jiva, right, or the, you know, the mind that's not attached to the things of you, then you have choices. Because right. You understand what it is and where it comes from, and you can, you know, like sort of at the mental, emotional, behavioral level, you can make these choices and have these responses that are informed by that knowledge rather than, and that gives a measure of control. What we right. talk about is control.
Right, and the model that, you know, yoga uses, it is that the gunas of nature, right? The thing that is not consciousness, the thing that is all of the drama of our lives, the thing that we most frequently consider to be us, but that yoga considers to be rather nature, whereas us is what's conscious of it. And so you'll have a statement in the Gita, for instance, it says, when you have stuff going on, it is the gunas interacting with each other. It is rajas. You know, we had a scuffle yesterday. It's rajas interacting with rajas.
Exactly.
You know, and only when your consciousness can see that you are not that, that you are the awareness of that, can you start to have this perspective on it that lets you start to respond differently or even see it as a different thing.
Yeah. Makes me emotional just thinking about it, actually.
How so?
I don't know. I just see so much, I don't know. It sounds a little cheesy to say it, but it, you know, it makes me aware of this, the sort of suffering that we do as humans around, you know, what the gunas wreak with us, you know, and how, you know, even doing our very best, sometimes we are really subject to that, intensity, or that, you know, all like really the emotions, honestly. And you know, it's sort of like a lifetime of work to just even uncover or make conscious those things that are so deeply ingrained. And I don't know, I get emotional inside.
Yeah.
About like how big that task is for
right.
like if I think about how big that task is just for me. And then I think about like how you and I go to that place with each other and how difficult that is. And then I think about like students and clients and how, you know, just like the circles of it get bigger until I kind of get to this place like wow, this is hard. This is like a big project, the humanity and the world. And I get, I don't know, there's some place I get to that's a little bit indescribable, and it's just emotional. And
yeah, I mean, I think that's a totally apropos response. And what I come to think more and more is we are, I don't even know if it's our nature or it's in our culture that we're supposed to conquer it. I mean, we have this like category of literature, you know, man versus man, man versus nature, man versus,
yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, I'm going to conquer life and then it's going to be okay.
Yep.
And I think that gets us in this framework where oh my God, it's so hard. How am I ever going to deal with this? But there's another way to look, and maybe it might take a whole other lifetime to be able to see it this way, but it could also be viewed as amazing and challenging and spectacularly dramatic, and like there's a line in the song, it was an old Kenny Loggins song, and it was like, an argument can be out of sight if you love to argue and you know how to fight, right? And it's like, if you can let go when the rajas comes up, like afterwards, you know, you can let it all go again and realize, whew, that was something. And, you know, that's going to happen again. And the next time it happens, you know that that happens. It's like life is going to have stuff happen. You know, people are going to be born and that's going to be like happy. And people are going to die and that's going to be sad. And there's going to be arguments and that's going to be challenging. And frustrations and all of that stuff. But we can have the emotions of it all, and if we can remember not to define ourselves as only that, but that those are experiences that we're having, then we can hold, I think, what is the appropriate perspective of living, that you're in the muck of it, you know, you're in the battle of Arjuna and Krishna, and you're also aware that that is not what defines you in the whole of it. The whole of it is the yoga, you know, the coming together of both of those aspects of us. And that, figuring that out, I think is a lifelong task. And we get better and better and better at it, but I don't know that we perfect it until we're quote-unquote perfected, you know?
Yeah,
it's baked, like the seeds of the karma, right? When all the seeds are baked, what is that line from the fourth pada?
I don't remember.
It's like, you know, you're no longer, you're baking the seeds of the karma so they no longer sprout with new karma.
Yeah, I just don't remember the line, yeah. But that's the idea.
Yeah.
But you know, like, that just seems to me to be a lot of times, because, you know, to me it can be, and this might have to do with my own karmic imprint, actually, but to me it feels like what we're really doing is sort of trying to understand what kind of Arjuna we are. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
what the circumstance, how the circumstances relate to the actions, and what are the, how am I going to approach this, and how am I going to get conscious of how do you step forward in the way that is the most expressive of who I am and the least harmful both to myself and to others around that expression. You know, and by harmful I mean like the least struggle, the least painful resistance, or
right.
You know what I mean, like, because it's you know, we're all just so unique, and what could be and to me it just really takes, like, the practice brings me more and more to a kind of a place where I'm just like clarifying and clarifying and clarifying more the seeds of this life karma, you know, so that those can get roasted, and that, you know, and that's a funny way to say it, but it is true. Like, there are things that have, you know, I have actual experience of, you know, on a smaller level, you know, moving past a thing, you know,
right.
Seeing something become more conscious, so that when I see it coming to me from the outside, I go, oh, that's that thing, and then I just make a choice about how to relate to it, and it doesn't flare into a rajasic entanglement or a tamasic entanglement.
Right.
And
I think, like, that's that's a noble accomplishment.
Right.
We don't see that because we're looking for the big thing, the whole enchilada.
Exactly.
Exactly.
I mean, and that's one of the things that it says in the last pada that I always really respond to, which is, you know, even once you're in this place where there's this, like, you know, the way it describes it is like a rain cloud of samadhi, like it's a constant felt sense of being consciousness embodying. And even once you're in that place and you're not making any new karma, right, you have to remember that seeds of karma may still be in your, you know, coming up from unconsciousness to consciousness, and that even once you're in that place, you have to be willing to go back to the practice that gets you back to
right.
to
you have to keep your
you
keep
have to
in
keep
your
keep doing your
yeah,
practice because
yeah.
stuff can come up,
right?
And like that to me just feels like the place, you know, if we are here, which is as below,
yeah,
the as below place, I have really been coming to think of it almost like we're in the womb, you know what I mean? We're in the womb of the mother. We're embodied. We are not disembodied. We are not perfected beings.
Right.
If we're here, we know that. Like, that's coming. Like, that's first thing you want to know. And then you can just kind of roll up your sleeves and get to work and go, what is this karma? You know?
Right.
And, you know, that's a huge discussion for people that, most of the time you say karma and people go, oh, karma, like instant karma. And,
right.
you know, it's like bad karma, good karma. And I feel like there's a little piece of me inside that goes, oh my gosh, you know, like, I have to go all the way back to that.
Right.
And remember that that's really where we are as a culture. Like, we just are not thinking along these lines for the most part because we're like, trying to make money and we're trying to like just, you know, buy a car and we have to like take the dog to the vet and, you know, I don't know, worry about paying for our kids' school. And, you know, those things are so present and real and normal, and yet, I don't know what the end of that sentence is, really.
Yeah, but we still have the potential to learn and grow. It's just a matter of doing it. You know, there was somebody in the meditation training that I just taught, and he kept bringing it back to these really simple notions, like that are we all just overstimulated, and that's what's going on. You know, and I said, well, you know, we're stimulated. And maybe that's a problem, but it's like if we don't get moments of learning to get still, then we can never relate to that, whatever's going on, the stimulation. You know, you might find that a stimulation is the nature of your karma, like to be in a fast-paced something or other. You know, we don't all have to live in Bali, even though you should all come to Bali in February, right?
Yes, come to Bali. Subliminal messaging.
But it requires taking steps in the direction of balance, and the balance is a thing that is a struggle to maintain and a challenge to maintain. And you know, when you're kids, you take on challenges like games. You try to do it. When you fail, you laugh, you know? And as you get older, we see it in
I didn't usually laugh when I failed. I was way too pitta.
Yeah, but we see it in class, in people try to fall out of even like tree pose, and they're so serious about it, you know? And when you fail to hold balance in your life, man, you're really serious about it. But our lives are, by their nature, going to require this incredible juggling act, this balancing act, where we have to figure out how do you maintain the seeing everyone as part of the wholeness,
right.
Recognizing that they are struggling just like me, giving, holding boundaries where I feel like I'm getting hurt, but not hurting someone else because they're also consciousness just like me. And to make all of that work, and not just one on one, but on me and everything in the universe that I have to interact with.
Well, that's the place where, for me, how we teach yoga goes a little off, because I think we should be teaching that specifically as part of the practice rather than just asana and meditation. And that's my soapbox, and I will beat that drum, because, you know, that does go missing, right? Because that is really hard.
Yeah.
When you have judgment or when you have unconscious patterning that creates that judgment or that whatever we see out there as bad and out there, and we get to start externalizing those feelings. And, you know, it's quite a natural human thing, I think, to do that. But it also is the nature of a lot of, you know, really of what I would say yoga, not just necessarily from like the Indian tradition, you know, but what I consider to be more of, you know, you used the word perennial before. Swami Rama talks about the perennial psychology. Well, a lot of people talk about, you know, perennial philosophy, which is this sort of common denominator of underlying, I don't even know you call it philosophy, but, you know, that's what we call it, that, you know, that shows up in underlying the various traditions.
Yeah, and I think maybe to say again what you said, because it might have struck some people as, well, wait, what else is there besides asana and meditation? But it's this whole realm of, on the way in, Svadhyaya, and on the way out, Samyama, that brings to light the kinds of things that we're talking about. That there's assessment and discernment and self-reflection and, you know, processing and seeing what's going on outside you and how does that relate to what's inside you.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's funny, I've been teaching the yamas and niyamas more and more lately, specifically as part of the practice. And, you know, they've been so identified with like the Ten Commandments of yoga and the sort of like rigid sort of rules of yoga, like do this and don't do this, that it's really, really, really hard for people to see that what they really are is part of the practice of yoga. The part, in fact, where we deal with this horizontal, external, internal axis of how I see the world, how I externalize, how I get stuck in what I see in the world and the actions and circumstances that I find myself in, and then how I get what I would, I don't know exactly how to say it, so it's simple, but how I get conscious of my involvement, and then from there bring myself back to an internal place so I can adjust how I'm experiencing and then go back out. And, you know, it's not like you do it once. It's obviously like you go out and in and out and in. And the way that I read how the yamas and niyamas work within that wheel of the eight limbs is that, you know, we're stuck in the outward world. We have to come in, and then from there we go into balancing the body and the breath and bringing the attention inward and going in into that meditative state from there, you know. And it's, and it works like a kind of a spiral or a wheel within a wheel of some kind,
right,
that keeps
right.
coming around and
you
around.
You don't graduate from sadhana.
You don't graduate from sadhana. And that's like, you know, I think we've just been really brainwashed in our contemporary Western world to feel like you can buy it or you can attain it or you can get there or you can, I don't know, shoot it or I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what all the metaphors, yeah. But you know, it's
you drink it down you, in Peru. Right?
You drink it, or you, yeah, yeah. So.
Yeah. So yeah, I agree, and well, I think maybe this is a great place to stop. It got really intense and in a really good way, and I wanted to say that. One of our intentions for the new year is to create more opportunities in person for people to come together in satsang, you know, to be together, because it's so supportive of one's sadhana. And, you know, when you and I get to talk in this way on the podcast, it provides a little bit of an example of what it would be like to have conversation around these, what I consider the most important topics. You know, it's like, this is deep living at its definitional place, you know, like, what are we living for?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, hashtag real talk. So, anywho, there's that, and then also you mentioned the yamas and niyamas, and you continue to do these trainings on the Yoga Sutras that are so profound and so personalized, not just a dissemination of academic knowledge about the sutras, but a chance to process some of that teaching into one's own living. And you're going to be continuing to do that in 2020, which is, I think, shaping up to be a pretty enlightened year.
Yeah, and also more subliminal messaging. I will be the guest lecturer in Bali in February with Peter and Aino, and I will be actually, I think my guest lecturing will be an investigation with the people on retreat of the yamas and niyamas that I've been doing. So it's a nice way to, a nice piece of contemplation for some beautiful beach experiences.
Fantastic. Well, Wendy, happy holidays in the truest sense of that word. May the light be with you. And
may the light be in you. May you be the light.
We are the light.
Yes, we are.
Namaste.
Namaste.
I'm hoping to support Peter's podcast, much like a pay-what-you-will yoga class. But there's no box at the front of the door here, so instead, I'm using the digital equivalent. That's why I'm asking you to please support Peter's podcast on patreon.com. Instead of a box, there's a link. It's easy, it's flexible if you want to vary your support, and most of all, it keeps this podcast going. Thank you to everyone who's already a podcast patron. And please check it out if you're not. Thank you. That's today's episode. Thanks a lot for listening to Peter's podcast. I hope that you find real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living through your practice. Namaste.